In Sudan, some child soldiers have become TikTok celebrities.
Some pages were inviting users to comment on which of the child soldiers they preferred. It seems that it's become like a viral phenomena.
I'm Marco Werman. Why the trend has experts concerned. Also in Mexico, a cartel boss was killed and chaos erupted.
We've never seen anything quite as widespread across so many different Mexican states.
Also, good news from the Galapagos, giant tortoises make a comeback.
We worked our way up the side of the volcano and discovered some very distinct-looking tortoises that really didn't seem to belong.
And remembering Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah.
Independence now. Tomorrow, the United States of Africa.
Today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. Buses and cars have been torched, so have banks and gas stations. Roads are blocked. That is the current situation across several states in Mexico since security forces killed one of the country's most wanted cartel bosses. Nemesio Oseguera Cervantes, known as El Mencho, was the leader of the cartel Jalisco New Generation. He was wounded during a capture operation and then died while being flown to Mexico City. President Claudia Sheinbaum tried to reassure the public at a press conference today, saying Mexico should be proud of its armed forces.
Lo más importante en este momento, pues, es garantizar la paz y la seguridad.
She went on to say that the nation's peace and security are the most important goals. Parker Asman is with Insight Crime. He starts our coverage today from Mérida on the Yucatan Peninsula.
El Mencho was originally from the state of Michoacán, and he got involved in drug trafficking in the 1990s and was later jailed, actually, in the United States for drug trafficking. He later returned to Mexico after serving his U.S. prison sentence and became a police officer. A short time later, he eventually left the force and joined a now defunct criminal group known as the Milenio Cartel. And after the Milenio Cartel split, he ended up going on to form what we now know as the Jalisco Cartel around 2012. So the group has been operating in Mexico for, you know, the better part of more than a decade.
So this show of force by Mexico's government and police has been met now with the show of force by cartels. How have members of Jalisco New Generation, this cartel, actually responded?
Yeah, Mexican officials came out today and reported that there were more than 250 blockades across 20 states in Mexico. So the scale of the response was extraordinary. In the past, we've seen similar responses to attempted arrests and killings of high-profile criminal leaders, but we've never seen anything quite as widespread across so many different Mexican states.
Are we certain that this Jalisco New Generation cartel is the only one exacting revenge?
The way in which the Jalisco cartel operates is through different criminal alliances with local criminal actors. So I don't think we know exactly who was behind all of the disturbances and all of the blockades.
We know that Mexican officials have taken out powerful drug kingpins in the past. What typically happens after the head of a cartel is captured or killed?
So in the past, we've seen that arresting or killing high-profile criminal leaders has often led to fragmentation within Mexico's criminal landscape, as well as increased violence as groups that remain are fighting for control over certain criminal economies. And in the CJNG's case, they maintain a franchise-style structure with different semi-autonomous regional factions that maintain alliances with local criminal actors to manage a range of criminal activities from drug production and trafficking to extortion rackets and fuel theft. So it's hard to know exactly what will happen next in this case, but we have seen in the past that the killing or capture of these high-profile leaders can often lead to fragmentation and outbreaks of violence.
So CJNG, that's the Jalisco New Generation Cartel. Is there a known successor in that organization likely to step in now?
There are a number of different regional leaders that could potentially have the power and influence to step in and unite some of the different factions. But I think it's still too early to tell, and we just don't know who could emerge that could potentially fill that void.
So Mexico's government has been under immense pressure from the Trump administration to crack down on the cartels. What is President Claudia Sheinbaum having to juggle as she weighs her own country's security while facing this U.S. pressure?
Yes, from the time that President Trump took office for his second term, we saw him use the threat of tariffs to push the Mexican government to do more to crack down on organized crime and the trafficking of illicit fentanyl. Later on, we saw the U.S. government designate a number of Mexican organized crime groups as foreign terrorist organizations, which also increased pressure on the Mexican government to act. So there is an extraordinary amount of pressure coming from the United States on the Mexican government to do more to crack down on organized crime groups and the different criminal activities that they're involved in.
We did hear from White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, who said that the U.S. provided intelligence support to the Mexican government for this operation. What did that cooperation likely look like?
Early reports suggest that the U.S. government provided certain intelligence to the Mexican military, and that intelligence, coupled with the intelligence that the Mexican military had gathered, allowed them to eventually locate El Mencho and carry out this operation that led to his killing. But we still don't know exactly the specifics of what intelligence was shared or how exactly that cooperation developed.
Is that kind of intel sharing unusual between the U.S. and Mexico?
I would say no. It's very common for the United States government and the Mexican government to share this type of intelligence, especially when they have a mutual interest in targeting certain criminal leaders.
Just following up on that, though, I mean, in terms of the security situation, the clock is also ticking toward the World Cup this summer, and Guadalajara is supposed to host some of those matches, Guadalajara being where a lot of this violence is happening right now, being the capital of Jalisco State. How much pressure does that spotlight add to the current security situation?
I think it adds a huge amount of pressure on the Mexican government when we think about the World Cup, and not only the national attention, but the international attention that an event like that brings. And I think the big question now is, what is the security situation going to be like in the lead up and during the World Cup? As we saw, the criminal response following the killing of El Mencho was spectacular and essentially paralyzed a major Mexican city. So I think there are going to be important security considerations moving forward when we think about such a major event being hosted in a city like Guadalajara.
And we should say that President Sheinbaum's party has multiple high-profile members facing serious allegations of ties to organized crime. How does that affect her ability to fight organized crime and the cartels?
Corruption does not affect any single political party. It is something in Mexico that has affected almost every major political party. And for all politicians, I think combating that type of corruption is certainly one obstacle to effectively combating organized crime groups.
How much do you get a sense on the ground that if the problem isn't solved, there's concern that the U.S. might actually use force and come into Mexico?
The Trump administration has made threats along those lines in the past, but I don't know if we know how serious the Trump administration is when it talks about taking military action in Mexico. So it's difficult to say at this point. I'm not sure we know whether the U.S. government would actually take that type of decisive action.
Parker Asman is with Insight Crime. He joined us from Merida on the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. In Iraq, there's been a multi-year drought that's creating all kinds of challenges for people in their daily lives. And one of those challenges is a threat to a culinary tradition. Mazgulf is considered Iraq's national dish. The recipe for river fish, butterflied and grilled over a wood fire, dates back to Sumerian times. But with the impacts of drought, authorities are dismantling thousands of fish farms in a bid to conserve water. Reporter Duri Buscarin traveled to Iraq for the story.
If you're looking for mazgulf in Baghdad, look no further than the Baghdadi Restaurant, an institution perched on the east bank of the Tigris River. In the outdoor kitchen, a holding tank keeps the fish alive while they wait for their fate. Not out of mercy, but because carp tastes the best when it's as fresh as possible. A few steps away, an open fire is surrounded by a ring of butterflied fish propped up on sticks, almost in a tent position while they roast. When it's perfectly crispy, the servers arrange the fish on a bed of fresh basil, tomato, and onion, with a bowl of orange tamarind sauce in a straw tray. They top it with hot loaves of flatbread and whisk it out to a table. It tastes best if you eat it with your hands. It's salty, crispy, almost buttery, and universally beloved.
This is my family, my wife,
and my son, Ahmed. Araf Al-Halil says the secret to a good maskouf is using the right kind of firewood from different fruit trees.
But it's special woods. Not all the woods make this taste. It's so delicious.
His wife, who calls herself Hakan, says this is a weekly meal for their family. We eat maskouf every Friday, she says, either at home or a restaurant. Al-Baghdadi's owner, Haji Hussein Al-Rubai, says the restaurant grew from a small reed shack on the riverbank. In the 60s, he says, this street was full of them. People would come with a fish they'd purchased or caught themselves, and they'd pay for it to be grilled and served right by the river. Many fish restaurants also served alcohol in those days. They closed down during deposed President Saddam Hussein's National Faith Campaign in the 90s. And then, during the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the whole street was blocked off as militants launched attacks from the riverbank into the green zone. But Al-Baghdadi reopened, built its reputation, and persevered. We're the only restaurant left from the old days, Al-Rubai says. He sells about 400 fish a day, but the drought and the health of the Tigris River is already having an impact on his business. There's no wild-caught fish available anymore, he says, and some of the tastiest species of river fish have disappeared almost entirely. That leaves only one kind of fish that's now the mainstay for fans of maskouf, carp, that's farmed in artificial ponds. To see this up close, I drove north for about an hour, following the Tigris River. Ali Kadem crouches on the metal frame of an outdoor feeder as he slowly drops fish pellets into the water, hoping to coax one to the surface. When it's quiet, they'll come, he tells me, through an interpreter. The carp grow in these big pools with a recirculating fountain in the middle, and the fish are a little shy today. But with some patience, their dark fins and silver-gray scales break the surface.
Here we go.
Oh! The fish are bigger than you might think. About 2 feet long, 5 or 6 pounds when they're fully grown. And they're Kadem's pride and joy. But 2025 was Iraq's driest year on record since 1933. To try and conserve water, the Iraqi government has singled out what it says are violations in the fish farming industry. In a statement last month, Iraq's Ministry of Water Resources said it dismantled 12,000 illegal fish farms this fall to protect the rivers and water distribution. It's a regular part of the agency's work, but this was its biggest campaign in a long time. And they came for Kadem's farm, too. Kadem says his family's pools were not illegal. They've been here since before he was born. And he says they were built with the proper approvals and paperwork. We walk to a nearby pool that was completely drained by government workers this fall. Cut electric lines from a nearby utility pole hang loose. He hangs his head, wipes his hands. Not a single drop of water remains, he says. What would you do in my place, Kadem says. He worries about his relatives, who depend on the income from the farm, the workers, who depend on him for their salaries. And the fish in these pools died when the water was drained. There wasn't enough time to save them. His frustration bubbles over. This is a valuable industry that benefits this country, he says. Why are they destroying it? And how am I supposed to live? Should I resort to looting? The dry, empty field before him gives him no answers. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin, Baghdad, Iraq.
You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Videos of children in Sudan have gone viral on social media, but these young TikTok stars appear to be child soldiers caught up in the country's civil war. Videos show adolescent boys wearing camouflage fatigues, some waving assault rifles. In this one, a child is seen yelling Allah Akbar, celebrating the seizing of a military base. This is all documented in a recent expose by investigative journalism group Bellingcat. They worked with Radio Dabanga, an independent Sudanese news organization. Sebastian Vandermeers is one of the authors of that investigation. So tell us what you found, Sebastian.
Yeah, so at the start of December, when the RSF captured a military base in Baba Nusa from the Sudanese military, we started seeing a lot of videos of child soldiers popping up on TikTok. So we decided to investigate, and we found that some of these videos were getting millions of views. The video that had the audio, which you just played, was viewed millions of times, and the audio was reused in hundreds of TikToks. And we found that there was really like almost a cult following going on TikTok around two specific child soldiers, which they referred to as lion cubs.
So the one we just played, the audio from that, this is after the seizure of a military base. What kinds of other things are we seeing in these videos?
Yeah, so it's specifically around that capture, we saw a handful of videos and we were able to geolocate three of those videos. So that means that we found the exact locations of those videos by comparing satellite imagery provided by Google Maps to specific features that we can see in the videos in the background. So we were able to pin that video with the assault rifle to the entrance of the military base at Baba Nusa. We saw another video of the child running towards the main entrance. And then another one from inside the military base in which he films himself with around 10 dead bodies. We also see the child being paraded on top of the shoulders of a senior commander of the RSF called Sally Al-Futi. The child appears in a host of videos which experts told us glorify and normalize the participation in conflict for young people and might risk increasing recruitment in the civil war.
I know TikTok has taken down some of these accounts for these videos. What is the latest on that?
The story went up on Friday. By Friday, they'd only taken down 7 of the 12 accounts that we flagged. For the remaining 5, they had only taken down specific posts which we highlighted. Then after publication on Friday, I checked again today and all the accounts were taken down. However, when we went and checked on Friday after publication, we could also just search the names of the children on TikTok and Facebook, and dozens of videos on different accounts were still up.
Before removal, though, these videos, as you said, were getting major traction, millions of views on TikTok, and some of these accounts had hundreds of thousands of followers. What do you know about who's running these TikTok accounts?
It's hard to say. Several of the accounts seem to have been run by the children themselves. For the RSF and the SAF child soldier, we saw that he had 700,000 followers, but it was clear that the SAF child soldier's videos were filmed in a choreographed way. He appeared with political and military leaders, so he had some access, and it suggests that other people might have been helping him with his content. For the other pages, there was pro-RSF and pro-SAF TikTok pages, which have now been taken down, which had hundreds of thousands and in some cases over a million followers, which had reposted many of these videos showing the child soldiers. It's hard to say who's running those, but at least we can say that they're aligned with different sides of the war in Sudan.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. The accounts, as far as you can tell, are being run by both sides of this conflict, the RSF and the National Army.
That's correct. And then we even have some pages which are posting TikToks inviting users to comment on which of the child soldiers they prefer, the RSF or SAF one, by commenting one or two in the comment section. So it seems that it's become like a viral phenomena, which we haven't seen before in any context with child soldiers on TikTok.
Do we have any sense how many child soldiers are fighting in Sudan and how they've been recruited?
That's extremely difficult to say. So I read over the documents of the UN fact-finding mission, which took place in 2024. It concluded that the RSF has systematically recruited child soldiers, including into combat roles. The Sudanese armed forces, it's suspected, also had recruited child soldiers, but it said that it required more investigation. The key part of this investigation, though, which is important to highlight, is that under the Paris Principles, which Sudan is a state party of, a child soldier is any child which does any function for the military. They don't have to be directly involved in hostilities. And with the RSF one, it's quite possible that he was directly involved with hostilities. We saw him at the capture of a military base. However, the SAF child soldier seems to be more of a propaganda tool, a mascot almost, used by the SAF.
We know how hard it is to keep a lid on these kinds of social media accounts. They get removed, and often they might appear elsewhere under a different handle. What has TikTok said about this and their efforts to remain vigilant as this war in Sudan continues?
So we flagged them to TikTok, and initially they removed seven of the 12 accounts we flagged, as I said. They said that they removed 98% of this content before it was uploaded. However, we found that when we simply searched the name of the child on TikTok after publication, we could still just see dozens of videos from different users. Less viral, though, because we focused on reporting the most viral accounts and the videos with millions of views cropping up again. I've also seen more accounts of both child soldiers popping up, posting the new videos again. So it does seem to be a real problem that they're dealing with.
So last Friday, as you said, when your investigation was published, that seemed to be an alarm for TikTok and they removed accounts. Do you understand why, though, those videos were able to linger so long on social media?
We talked to some experts on this, in particular, Sarah T. Roberts from the Center for Critical Internet Inquiry at UCLA. Emphasized that social media companies tend to prioritize content which has stronger regulatory pressure, such as child sexual exploitation content. They tend to deprioritize things such as child soldiers in Sudan, which sees less regulatory pressure. So that might be part of the explanation. Mara Fatafta from Access Now also mentioned that Meta's approach to content moderation is extremely ad hoc, non-transparent, and inadequate. And it's hard to see how they have a consistent approach to moderating content coming from different conflict zones.
That was researcher Sebastian van der Meers of Bellingcat. We reached out to TikTok for comment on the story. A spokesperson replied by email saying the company removed content and accounts that violated rules against facilitating and depicting human trafficking, including child soldiers. The great trombonist and songwriter Willie Colon died over the weekend. His songs and his sound form the backbone of salsa music. One album cover made to look like an FBI wanted poster claimed Colon was armed with trombone and considered dangerous. This track is a great example of why. Que lio, or what a mess, with Hector Lavoe on vocals. Ayúdame. The song is about a guy who got into a mess by falling in love with his best friend's girlfriend. Help me, cries Lavoe before Willie Colon takes one of his blistering solos. Music from the late Willie Colon. He was 75. More global stories coming your way. Stay with us. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Europe has some ambitious energy goals, slashing greenhouse gas emissions while embracing renewables. But that plan is showing signs of strain. France has announced it is doubling down on nuclear power and investing less in wind and solar. In Germany, car makers have pushed to extend the life of gas and diesel engines beyond a key cutoff date for building them. These pressures are forcing leaders across the EU to strike a balance between environmental goals and economic prosperity. From Barcelona, the world's Jerry Haddon has more.
In a 2017 interview with the conservation group World Wildlife Fund, newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron said France was overly dependent on nuclear energy. I don't think it's a good idea that we rely on nuclear for 75% of our power, he said. The answer, he said then, was less fission and more wind farms, more solar parks. Then, last week,
il nous faut reprendre le fil.
Let us re-embark on our great nuclear adventure, he said on French TV. Macron was announcing a radical shift in energy policy. We're building 6 new nuclear power plants, he said, and postponing the phasing out of 14 older plants, while slashing investments in renewables.
À ceux qui affirment que nous n'aurions pas besoin de nucléaire.
To those who say we can live without nuclear, he said, try to imagine what we'd need to fill the gap. 40,000 new wind turbines on top of our 8,000, he said, plus 90 offshore wind farms. Right now we have one, and they each take 10 years to build. Under the new law, energy goals for wind and solar power will be cut by as much as 50%. But because nuclear power releases no greenhouse gases, Macron said, France is still on target to meet EU climate goals.
Europe has a clear objective to reach climate neutrality by 2050. This objective is an objective that mainly dictated by environmental concern.
This is Simone Tagliapietra, a senior fellow at Bruegel, a policy think tank in Brussels. France is re-embracing nuclear, he says, because it's stable energy and because renewables aren't enough. On top of that, Europe was dependent on Russia for the natural gas it needs to run current power plants. With the war in Ukraine, that's gone. Norway and the U.S. have stepped in to help, but Tagliapietra says Europe is still energy dependent, just now on allies. And as far as fossil fuels go, he says, that's not going to change.
Europe cannot replicate the Trump drill baby drill because we don't have anything to drill.
Given this, he says, it makes sense that France might choose to lean on nuclear power. Its state-owned energy company, EDF, already operates dozens of plants, and it's complained that it was losing money in renewables undercut by global competition.
This mix is for them to decide, obviously keeping in mind they have committed to meeting the overall EU goals. So we let member states choose what energy mix they want to use.
Anna-Kaisa Itkonen is spokeswoman for the European Commission for Energy, Climate and the Environment. Nuclear energy in France is fine, she says, because renewables are still in the overall mix.
We're doing okay. We saw a record deployment of renewables in European Union. Almost 50% of our electricity was coming from renewables in 2024.
Electricity for things like keeping the lights on at home. But the larger challenge is for fossil fuel-dependent industries like construction or car making. That's where the strongest pushback is against EU climate goals. Last year, German carmakers pressured Brussels to suspend a 2035 end date for making gas-burning vehicles. The EU complied, though Itkonen says it wasn't capitulation, but compromise. The 2035 deadline goes away, she says, but gas motors must reduce tailpipe greenhouse emissions by 90% compared to 2021 levels.
The car was invented in Europe, and we want to keep it that way. We want our car industry to be the guiding light in technologies and manufacturing kind of new low-carbon models.
As for the other 10%?
The remaining 10% need to be compensated with renewable fuels and clean steel made in the European Union.
Zero net emissions is still Europe's North Star, she says, but stability and predictability have to be a part of the equation. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll be taking time to mark the 4th anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. There's another anniversary coming tomorrow that we wanted to focus on right now, an event that still carries weight across much of Africa, especially in Ghana. 60 years since Ghana's first president, Kwame Nkrumah, was overthrown in a military coup. Nkrumah had been a champion of Pan-Africanism, envisioning a world where independent African nations would function as a political and economic bloc. Here he is speaking at the All African People's Conference in 1958.
This decade is the decade of African independence. Forward then, to independence. To independence now. Tomorrow, the United States of Africa.
Ghana, a former British colony, had been the first sub-Saharan African country to break from European rule. And Nkrumah's overthrow in 1966 sparked difficult questions about the future of newly independent nations. Recently, I spoke with Howard French about this pivotal moment in African history. He's the author of many books, including his latest, The Second Emancipation, Nkrumah, Pan-Africanism, and Global Blackness at High Tide. Howard, let's start with a little background on Kwame Nkrumah. What do listeners need to know going into this conversation about who this towering political figure was?
So Kwame Nkrumah was a person born into a very poor family, a household that had multiple wives for one husband, and in a colony, a British colony in the early 20th century, in the first decade, where the British had invested almost nothing in schooling. Britain was extracting huge amounts of wealth from the Gold Coast, as it was then called, through gold, and especially through cocoa. And Kwame Nkrumah's mother persuaded his father, even though she was a junior wife, to send him to a Catholic church one-room schoolhouse. And Kwame Nkrumah got the attention of the colonial authorities at a rare moment of reformism and colonial rule. He goes to the capital, Accra, just as a fancy high school was being built. He excels there, and this is really decisive in his life. He goes to the United States, to Lincoln University, a historically black university, to study. He goes to London, where he becomes active in African student movements. And this really puts him on the path to returning to Ghana as a political leader of this colony on the eve of what would become its independence moment.
So his foundational role in the idea of Pan-Africanism and what it really was about is critical to understanding who Nkrumah was. I want to save those questions for just a bit. But first to why Nkrumah was overthrown in 1966. I mean, after Ghana gained independence in 57, Nkrumah seemed genuinely intent on creating a democratic state. But by the mid-60s, he had essentially established single-party rule in Ghana. What happened to those early ideals?
I'm not sure that ideals were the problem. I think that reality was the problem. Nkrumah assumed power. He won power peacefully, overwhelmingly, through a series of elections, the first held while he was being held in prison and against the wishes of the British. He won a series of elections that forced their hand to giving him the keys to the colony and its independence. Nkrumah was a man in a hurry, I think for good reasons. He understood that if Africa did not find ways to consolidate quickly in the early independence era, then Africa would become the prey of superpower rivalries and the clinging tendencies even of the former colonial powers. And so Kwame Nkrumah, the leader of a rather modest African country in terms of size and population, understood that he had to go fast, but he had inherited very few human resources with which to build the country. There was almost no British investment in education in Ghana until the time he went to high school. And so he quickly found himself beset with some very hard realities. One, fast-growing competition of the superpowers to impose themselves on the grid of Africa. Two, a kind of mean-spirited opposition that often took a kind of ethnic view to politics in Africa. And then three, the fact that world cocoa prices collapsed. I don't applaud the outcome, but I think Nkrumah, like so many other leaders in the world, leaned on or resorted to increasingly authoritarian methods to try to force things forward, to try to force the agenda and keep moving Ghana forward. This produced a tragic outcome. But as I researched this book and looked very carefully at the period, I actually didn't see a whole lot of alternatives readily available to Nkrumah.
Well, I mean, I want to pick up on the fact that Nkrumah found himself in the middle of a Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. He was also interested in getting more involved in the anti-colonial struggles of other African nations, even wanting to commit Ghanaian troops to fight elsewhere on the continent. How did that play into the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR?
Well, Ghana becomes independent in 1957 after almost a decade of pushing forward in these elections that Nkrumah repeatedly won. And then right away in 1958, you played the tape. Nkrumah begins to organize African-scale conferences, drawing in newly independent leaders of newly independent countries and leaders of independentist movements from around the continent. A whole host of things begin to happen very quickly with Ghana and Nkrumah as the catalyst. In 1958, Guinea, 500, 600 miles west down the coast of West Africa, becomes independent. And in 1960, 17 African countries become independent. Almost all of those became independent in a peaceful way, with the hand of the Europeans being increasingly forced by the momentum unleashed by Nkrumah with the example of Ghana.
So Nkrumah was overthrown in February of 1966. He was on a mission to North Vietnam, the communist North at the time. His stated goal on that trip was to help end the war there. What does that tell us about Nkrumah's worldview?
And Nkrumah thought that Africa should be a player on the world scene, that that was Africa's rightful role in the world. And this feeds from his Pan-Africanism. Nkrumah believed that Africa would never really be able to do this in a sustained way unless Africa federated and created larger and larger unions, ultimately leading perhaps in some distant future to the United States of Africa that he spoke to in the tape that you played. Another thing that less charitable that this might speak to is to Nkrumah's ego. In fact, I think this was viewed as impardonable by the United States under the Johnson administration. Who is this this African guy going off to Vietnam, getting involved in an American conflict and having the pretense of being able to propose himself as a mediator or as a peacemaker in something that has nothing to do with him? If I had to sort of decide which side of the ledger to be on morally, ethically, in this situation, I think I would choose Nkrumah's side. But the United States and the West, and in fact, the rivalries of the Cold War were not prepared to cede space to a figure from Africa like Nkrumah to play on the world stage in that way.
So while he's out of the country in Vietnam, Nkrumah is overthrown by the Ghanaian military. What should we know about that coup?
One of the most important things to know about the coup is that it was fostered, encouraged, or given a green light, at least in an informal way, by the UK and by the United States.
By the CIA specifically, right?
That's correct.
I'm speaking with writer Howard French about Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first president overthrown 60 years ago. Howard, let's get back to Nkrumah's thinking around Pan-Africanism. And one thing we need to discuss that is adjacent to Nkrumah's desire to assist other African nations in their struggles, his role, really his foundational role as a Pan-Africanist. What did Pan-Africanism really mean for Nkrumah?
Pan-Africanism's sort of bedrock principle is that in a tough world, a balkanized Africa will only be able to stand on its feet if it finds ways of creating new polities, bigger polities that erase the colonial borders and create larger, more viable nations. There's one more beat to this that Nkrumah pursued and other thinkers also advanced, and that is that Pan-Africanism should take a large view of blackness, that Africans who embrace Pan-Africanism should welcome people from the African diaspora, African-Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, Afro-Europeans, back to Africa to play a constructive role if they wish.
So we heard Nkrumah in that clip from 1958 earlier, Howard, speaking about a United States of Africa almost federalizing the continent. How did that idea evolve during Nkrumah's tenure as president?
Well, there was a big showdown in 1963 at the very first meeting of the Organization of African Union, which is now called the African Union. And Nkrumah went there to present a plan for the consolidation of Africa. And unlike what many people imagine, he did not propose and did not expect people would snap their fingers and all of a sudden there would be one African country. However, he did articulate a vision that drew on the ideas of American independence, wherein 13 separate British colonies surrendered their limited local sovereignty to form a larger whole that could be more powerful and more prosperous on that basis. Nkrumah invoked the Federalist Papers and American independence history to try to persuade other African leaders to follow him down this road and to begin to work in practical ways toward federation. But unfortunately, the French colonies, former French colonies in particular, and the larger Anglophone colonies like Nigeria opposed Nkrumah's vision.
So when you look at a young leader today, like Bobi Wine in Uganda, for instance, and you hear his rhetoric, I mean, this is a man who's been trying to unseat President Yoweri Museveni, who, like Nkrumah, came to power espousing democratic intentions, but now has become an authoritarian. How do young modern leaders see a Pan-Africanist future?
So this is the thing about Nkrumah, where his resonance remains. Very few present-day African governments articulate or echo Pan-Africanism of the Nkrumah sort. There are a few exceptions. The Sahelian states like Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali maybe superficially do so. But Nkrumah-style Pan-Africanism has remained alive and vibrant in the hearts and minds of Africans as peoples and has never faded. And Africans at the individual level remain to a very high degree attached to the idea that Africa's fortunes are indivisible and that Africans have to find ways of working together and ultimately, in fact, of building bigger states together if they're going to prosper.
Howard, just to bring us back to Kwame Nkrumah, none other than New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, his middle name is Kwame, a name chosen by his parents to honor Nkrumah. That would seem to say a lot about the reach and afterlife of Kwame Nkrumah's ideas.
This is an expression of a belief by the father in Kwame Nkrumah's type of Pan-Africanism, a Pan-Africanism that is not a racial Pan-Africanism. Mahmoud Mamdani is born in India, but he's a Ugandan national. And Kwame Nkrumah was very much a non-racialist. Kwame Nkrumah, many people in his personal team were actually Europeans, British people in particular. His closest advisor in personal terms had been the British secretary of the former colonial governor. He was very explicitly non-racialist. And so American listeners might have trouble figuring out how to parse this, right? Somebody banging away at Pan-Africanism, they might imagine as somebody who's thinking just in terms of blackness. That's not at all who Kwame Nkrumah was. Kwame Nkrumah had a capacious idea of Pan-Africanism and said, if you're an African, by whatever means, you're welcome within this concept. And so I think Mahmoud Mamdani's choice of that name has something to do with Kwame Nkrumah's progressive politics, broadly speaking, but also something to do explicitly with this notion of an open-ended Pan-Africanism.
Howard French is the author of The Second Emancipation, Nkrumah, Pan-Africanism, and Global Blackness at High Tide. Thank you very much, Howard. Good to speak with you again.
Thanks so much, Marco.
You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Once again, in the Galapagos on the island of Floriana, the giant tortoises are walking. Slowly, of course. The iconic species known appropriately as the Floriana giant tortoise has been hunted to extinction on the island. Conservationists have now successfully reintroduced just over 150 young tortoises to the area. James Gibbs has been researching these creatures for about 2 decades. In fact, he is the one who discovered the descendants of the Floriana tortoises on Wolf Volcano that made this reintroduction possible. Today, Gibbs is with the Galapagos Conservancy. We reached him earlier today on Santa Cruz Island in the Galapagos. He began by describing these creatures.
They have a very dark shell, but they have a very sculpted shell, which is to say they have this real saddle backing, which is very distinct from the round shells that most tortoises have. And they are, of course, gigantic. Of the ones in collections, we can see they would probably easily get to 500, 600 pounds. We know they get up to 150, 160 years old. And there are records of tortoises getting, giant tortoises getting to 200 years plus. And they never really slow down. They never really stop breeding. And they're really quite remarkable, resilient animals.
And so how different are these descendants from the Floriana tortoise that you discovered and which have been reintroduced?
Yes. So basically, while they have stayed together in particular areas, they have interbred with the endemic or the native species on the volcano, which is a domed tortoise. So what we have today, they're hybrids, all with significant lineage from the Floriana tortoise, you know, anywhere from 10 to 40, 50, 60, 70% Floriana tortoise in these hybrids.
So, James Gibbs, talk about the process of getting to this point where you were able to reintroduce these giant tortoises to their native habitat. How did this come about?
It's been quite a process, 26 years to be exact, but it has gone in stages. First was the discovery, and then was the confirmation that actually were descendants of these Floriana tortoises. Then the whole sort of logistics operation to find and remove these particular tortoises of interest to the Fausto Llerena Breeding Center of the Galapagos National Park here on Santa Cruz Island, where they have been ensconced in a large corral, lava block corral, where they have been breeding happily over the last, 10 to 15 years. And they're very prolific in producing youngsters, and they're producing about 100 little tortoises every year now. And at age five, basically, they've been head started and they're in good shape to go out, be released to the wild and fend for themselves.
So you've got this corral of Floriana giant tortoises. You know the right time when they're mature enough to be released. But when did it become clear that reintroduction was possible?
This whole process of introduction of tortoises to Floriana Island is part of a much larger effort to restore the entire island. And the Floriana Restoration Project undertaken by the National Park and many other partners has focused on the removal of many different kinds of invasive species, most prominently the goats and cattle that had been introduced, and then cats and rats. Black rats were introduced, and they are potential predators, especially the rats on young tortoises. So this opened the way. We'll continue to, of course, to introduce tortoises about 100 per year for the next 50 years or so. But there are an endemic snake, a racer, ready to come back, and a native mockingbird, several species of finches. But this the tortoises hopefully will usher in the beginning of a series of further introductions to bring back the native wildlife to Floriana as its ecosystems recover. And then the tortoises themselves will be an agent of recovery for the ecosystem. You know, they consume, you know, thousands of pounds of vegetation every year. They're big 500-pound animals that move around in very high densities. They disperse a lot of plants. They really are a key part of a healthy ecosystem, and going to be a big effort now moving forward. This was both the end of a 26-year effort, but just really the beginning of a much longer-term process of both more tortoises and helping other species get established.
That's very cool. So it's a significant moment, not just for the Floriana tortoise, but for other species, even flora as well. Just as a detective story, I mean, the arrival of these descendants of the Floriana tortoise is fascinating. How far from Floriana Island is Isabel Island, and what are your theories?
Yes, no, it's been quite a head-scratcher in terms of what happened, but fortunately, we're not completely in the dark on this. So these two islands are about as far apart as you can get in the Galapagos, and none of the ocean currents are sort of tend that way. How did they possibly get here? What we think happened, and it's more than just conjecture, is that we do know the whalers, most of whom were out of the, you know, New England, Boston, Nantucket, Cape Cod area. One of the first stops they made was to collect tortoises. They really depended on huge stores of tortoises on board to sustain themselves as a source of food while hunting sperm whales. So they collected a lot of tortoises, and we also know they traded and moved them. There's a record of the USS Essex, a Navy ship, a U.S. Navy ship, finding two British warships, engaging with them, and both, all ships, prior to their firefight, clearing their decks of hundreds and hundreds of giant tortoises right in front of this very remote volcano where we found these Floriana lineage tortoises. And surely some of those ultimately fetched up on the shore and maybe are the tortoises that, you know, made their way to the base of the volcano, interbred a little bit with the native tortoises present, and were those that we ended up finding, 26 years ago as hybrids.
Just one more thing, James. If these tortoises can live for more than 100 years, is there any chance that some of the turtles on Wolf Island that you discovered were the original Floriana tortoises?
Great question. I've often wondered that, and I think yes. I think the answer to that question is yes, because the time frame is reasonable. I mean, it's getting to the extent of their potential lifespan, but we have found some of these hybrid tortoises with such a high quotient of the Floriana genome that they have had to have had a pure parent, and that pure parent needs to still be out there on Wolf Volcano. There are, we estimate, 12,000 tortoises. It's a little bit of a needle in a haystack looking for and finding them, but I think there's a good chance. It's only, you know, three or four tortoise generations at most. In fact, I'm pretty sure some tortoises that Darwin gazed upon are still alive today, gazing upon us. So yes, the time frame is such that those original tortoises moved by the whalers could still be out there.
James Gibbs is Vice President of Science and Conservation with the Galapagos Conservancy. We reached him today on Santa Cruz Island in the Galapagos. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.